My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, everybody, and you're very welcome back to the Young Stock Podcast, the podcast by young journalists for young readers and listeners from the Irish Farmers Journal, supported by MOCRA. Amy Ford here from the news team, and I'm your host this week. Now, the ground is saturated in parts, cattle are housed, dare I say it, we're on the countdown to Christmas. If you're a young farmer, a young person in rural Ireland, working in agriculture, or want to hear more about rural life, then this is the place for you. To get in touch with your opinions and feedback on the podcast, you can email youngstock@farmersjournal.ie or leave a WhatsApp voice note at 086-836-6465. Coming up on this week's show, we'll have the latest Mart prices, this week's sustainability fact of the week, and of course, the big interview. And this week, I talk to Eimear Wallace. Eimear is a young beef and sheep farmer from the hills in Mam in County Galway. We'll hear more from her later, but first up this week, news journalist Noel Bowden has a news update and wants to get your opinions on some hot topics.
In this week's news, we cover the record feed costs farmers are set to face this winter, based off our own survey of farmers from all parts of the country. An average of 120 to 130 euro a tonne has been added on to the price of concentrate feed just from last year. This will add about 2,000 euro to the average feed bill of a 35-cow suckler farmer keeping on his weanlings, and will leave winter finishers needing about 6 euro a kilo just to break even. The deadline for submitting applications to the first round of the new acre scheme has been pushed back by 2 weeks. Instead of farmers and advisors needing to have applications in by the 21st of November, they'll now have until the 5th of December. We've covered off the pressure that advisors are under to get farms visited and to get plans in, so no doubt that they'll be happy with their extra 2 weeks. And also this week we hear from auctioneers who are saying that high dairy farmer demand is driving land leases beyond 400 euro an acre in some parts of the country. You can see that it is becoming very tricky for young farmers in those areas to get a foot on the land.
Thanks very much, Noel. Next up, we have Ellen Durkin with her sustainability fact of the week. But before we go any further, here's a quick word from our sponsor, MOCRA.
Looking for somewhere to talk about all things farming? Then make sure to join MOCRA and Afirma. Our Ag Affairs Committee are always on top of the latest farming issues and want to hear what you have to say. But we're all about having the crack too, which is why we have plenty of events and competitions happening all the time. So what are you waiting for? Sign up to MOCRA today and make sure to add the promo code PODCAST so you will be entered into a draw to win 2 tickets to a concert of your choice in the Three Arena. Sign up via our website, mocra.ie.
This week's sustainability fact of the week is that it takes 17 kilograms dry matter of 75 DMD silage to put on 1 kg of carcass, as opposed to 46 kg dry matter of 60 DMD silage to put on 1 kg of carcass weight. This means that by making good quality silage, farmers can cut back on supplementary feeding and concentrates, which can help make their farms more economically sustainable, especially in light of the increasing cost of concentrates. However, in order to know how good or bad their silage is, and to determine supplementation rates, farmers must first get their silage tested. So what is measured in a silage test? Dry matter. Dry matter is the amount of silage material left after the water has been removed. The higher the dry matter, the higher the potential intake of the silage. The fermentation, which is described by pH, ammonia and lactic acid. pH, normally 3.8 to 4.2, measures the silage acidity and the ability of the silage to store. Ammonia is a good indicator of fermentation quality. Values of less than 10% are desirable. Greater than 15% can reduce intakes. High nitrate levels in grass can contribute to this. Lactic acid is produced at ensiling. Ensiling quickly reduces the pH of the silage and acts as a preservative. Crude protein. Crude protein is an indicator of the quality of grass at the time of the harvest. Young leafy grass has higher protein levels, and protein levels will also be higher earlier in the silage season in comparison to midsummer. Metabolizable energy. Metabolizable energy is the measurement of the usable energy of the silage. It is higher at a young leafy stage. The DMD. The DMD, or the dry matter digestibility, is an accurate test of the feeding value of the forage. DMD is used to estimate the energy value of the silage, as well as the expected live weight gains, milk yields and supplementation rates. DMD of greater than 70% is desirable.
Thanks, Ellen, for that insight. Now, for this week's big interview, Emer Wallace, as I said earlier, is farming back in Mam, Connemara, County Galway. She's farming hill sheep and cattle with her family. This week, we discuss farm politics, fencing hills with the assistance of a helicopter, and the challenges facing young hill farmers in Ireland. Hey, Emer Wallace, tell us a bit about yourself. Who's Emer Wallace? Where are you from? What do you do?
Hi, Amy. So, my name is Emer Wallace. I'm from Mam. So we've got a family farm back home. So I'm the youngest of three, the only daughter as well. So save the best to last. We'd be like from a hill farm as well, but when I'm not farming, I suppose, my actual job is within the university. So I'm based off the University of Galway at the moment, finishing off my PhD / doing a postdoc. I'd be in the research field. So if it's not farming or doing research, I'm also massive into GA as well. So it's kind of me really in a nutshell.
Okay, and tell us a bit about your farm at home. Obviously, we often talk of the west of Ireland, and sometimes that doesn't expand back beyond Lough Corrib or the depths of Mayo, shall we say. You're proper west of Ireland, we should say, in County Galway.
Yeah, so definitely west of Galway. So I'd be from anyone that likes to do any hiking or hill walking, it'd be the Mam Turks region. So we'd have one of the peaks of the Mam Turks where we'd have all our sheep would be out there most of the year. They actually just came in there on Saturday, just gone by. We were gathering them up for the rams. So it's a bit of a trek when you're doing some hill walking. You have to go all the way to the top of the hill, bring them down and come across rivers and commons to bring them in. So for that, like, you'd want some good hardy sheep. So we'd have the Connemara black face at home, mixed with some Texels. So we have the hill Texels. As well as the thing, we'd have the cattle on the farm. We wouldn't have as many cows as we do sheep, but we've the speckled parks as well, which are a great hardy breed. And so that's kind of our way. Like, the cattle would stay at home pretty much all the year, but the sheep would be the ones that would be going out to the hill.
And tell us a bit about the gather, I suppose. Look, for the uninitiated, it's not just going out to a field and taking them. As you said, you're going up to the top. Have you got a couple of dogs? Are you using quads? What's the story there?
Yeah, well, the quad is absolutely zero use to you. I suppose compared to, we'll say, dairy cattle, dairy farmers bringing in the dairy cows for milk, and you definitely wouldn't have it as handy. No offense to them now, but it's not a straightforward go out to the field and see where they are and bring them in. Up until, I suppose, the summer of COVID, so I suppose up until 2 years ago, the top of our hill wasn't fenced at all. So all the Mam Turks, you'd have, say, in a lot of the cases, you'd have fences going up the side of your hill, but then the top, because it's all stones and rocks, it's not fenced, so it's just open territory. So you go up and hope that your sheep are where they should be, in between two fences, but they can wander for a fair decent kilometres. You know, you could have sheep, I being from, say, Mam, you could have sheep, if you want, they could go to Recess, they could go to Clifton direction. So they can cover ground. So you definitely would want a couple of dogs. Myself and my brother would normally do the gather together. So we'd have a dog each, really. So it would involve, like, you'd walk, I suppose, a good 30, 40 minutes. It depends what farm we're in, if we want to race each other, how fast we can get up to the top. And then you'd have to gather all the top. Now, it's a lot easier now, because there, 2 years ago, we decided, I suppose, I don't know if it was something I was excited to do, shall I say, but my brother was mad to get it done, was fence the top of our hill off. So it keeps out the other sheep from the other side of the hill, so our sheep get the best of the land. So that makes it a lot easier, because the sheep can't be escaping on. Yeah, but that involves getting a helicopter as well. So I don't think that's something that a lot of lowland people will be getting, is a helicopter to do some fencing. Yeah, for the gather, I suppose, to go back to that, you bring your sheep down as much as you can. And then, you know, the mother and the father are called in to help as well, because the mam would have to be down at the gap, down at the bottom of the hill to open a gate. So the sheep would walk out of common, and they're used to it now. Like, they've been doing that, I suppose, it's a family farm. It's been in the generation since the late 1800s anyway. So the sheep have been doing that same walk time and time again. So they'll, you know, once the gate's open, they know where to go. And you're going one way, you cross the river, so they turn up another common until you get back into what we call the holding in our house. And they're in there then for the ram. So they're in a nice, small, confined area. So at least the ram can hopefully tip them good and quick and have lambs in a couple of months. So it's everyone, all hands on deck when it comes to the gathering, because, you know, you don't want them straying away when you've got them from the top.
For sure. And tell us a bit more about this helicopter. Now, I can't let you go without telling us more about that. Tell us about that. How come you had to get a helicopter in there?
Yeah, so I suppose most people, when you come to fencing, I suppose you think of a tractor, you think of a pole driver, you know, you get your load of stakes dropped off and the coils of wire. But if you have to walk to the top of the hill, like, you're talking, you know, is it a couple of hundred or a couple of thousand foot nearly, like, so carrying a couple of coils of wire on your back or bale of stakes, good luck. You're not going to get a quad to bring them up there either. So I suppose all the farmers in the valley, it's been a long time waiting, trying to organize a helicopter and everything, and COVID didn't help and things like that. So everyone, basically more or less everyone that fences in the valley, came together, and we'd have all mam kind of crew moon, I suppose, out Finney direction as well. So it's kind of all the neighboring parishes come together, and we hire out a helicopter for today. So it kind of involves a lot of, to be honest, there is a good bit of planning. Like, we have the base, which will be at the community centre in our village, ma'am. And whoever's good in the area, with geography or whatever, will be the person left with the map and the pilot. And at the top of the hill, you'll have, say, wherever you want a fence. Like, we have four drops or so. So you put out, say, a luminous jacket, something that's really bright to see from the sky. And you have stones put on them so that they're not going to blow away. And you try to pick it to spread it out over the top. Like, you're talking, I suppose, 10 coils of wire, whatever, 500 yards, say, across 500 yards, you might have five drops. So you space them out. You also have to try and find a spot that's quite level, so that when the drop is done, that they don't roll all the way down the hill. You'd be crying if that happened. So, you know, you might have, I suppose, 100 stakes and some coils of wire left in one drop and do it to the other. So it's definitely, there is a good bit, you know, the planning, neighbours do it all together, and then, you know, you have to pay your fair share of the helicopter, but it wouldn't be possible otherwise. Like, so then once we had the stakes and the wire up there, you have to make sure you remember to put up the grobar and the sledge, because that's how you're going to put down the stakes. Like, myself and my brother, it was torturous. I remember saying to my brother, he ran me out of the country. Like, I moved to Italy shortly after it for 2 years, because I'd get up, would say, on the weekends I'd finish work, and on a Saturday morning I'd be getting up around 2:30, 3:00 in the morning, making the lunches for the day, and I'd have the backpack with all the lunch in it, the brother would have the backpack with all the staples and the hammers in it, and we'd head off, we'd just literally walk, climb to the top of the hill, and start our 10-12 hour shift of just fencing. Like, he'd be putting down the stakes, so I'd be going ahead, laying out the stakes, carrying them from place to place, and you'd be using the grobar, trying to go through stone to create a hole for the actual stake to go down, and then you're trying do the wire and everything. And even one of the days we got the neighbor passion to help us as well. Like, so it was an ordeal. Like, I'm glad the hill won't, I don't think it'll have to hopefully be refenced again for another 10-15 years. So I kind of retired from fencing, or so I hope anyway. I'm the brother can stay doing the fencing from here on out, but at least it makes, you know, it makes the gather a lot easier because the sheep can't be escaping for miles or anything. So, but yeah, there was definitely excitement in the village when the helicopter came around anyway.
Yeah, jeepers, and a real community effort. You can really hear that as well from what you've said, Emer. Tell us a bit about the cattle side on at home, about the breeds and what you're doing with them.
We've the speck of parks now at home. I got into them, I suppose, probably about 10 years ago now, nearly over 10 years ago. So back in the day when I was at home full-time and the brothers were away at college, we'd the local AI man, John McCann, came along, and I this cow, she was a boshing cow. She wasn't the finest of animals. I was looking for like an easy calfer that you could put a bit of meat on the calf, and he kind of had come across the spec park. Was he hadn't used the breed before or anything, and I was like, oh sure, give it a go, we'll see how we get on. And smashing bull calf out of her, and never looked back. Then I went to source bull, and we got a spec park bull, and then we stayed with them ever since. They're kind of like, for anyone that wouldn't know, it's almost like a mix of an Angus, maybe Shorthorn mixing together, and like having growth rates or something like similar, like a limousine. So it's a really hard, hardy animal that's, you know, suitable for, we'll say, mountainous land like we have. But if you go on lowland, they really thrive. Like, we get all our bulls now off Edward Buckley down in Cork. So it's such a difference. Like, if we sell off one of the heifers down to Cork, like the difference of how they thrive on that land and everything. And so we've ended up literally, I think now, is it about 3/4 bred speck of parks now at this stage from homebred. We would have had the limousines back in the day. I suppose the founding cow there, Bow Wow, she would have been my pet cow. Like, she's literally all the cattle now we have are her descendants, really. And she's still going strong, to be honest. So she's what, 14 now. So she was, we just blood tested her there, and she's back in calf again. So it's gas, but we never look back with the speck of parks because they're all polled as well. You don't have to be worrying about dehorning or anything like that. And we even had a set of twins out of the breed as well. So they're a great like breed to get into, and they're so easy to sell on as well. Like, you nearly have, once you have a heifer, a speck of park, it's, you know, kind of have, look at your list of people that you've sold to recently or through the past, and they'll be looking to buy again, or they'll have recommended. We even had a few pedigrees as well. And selling on the pedigree bull calves out of them or the heifers, it was again, like, there's just a good market for them at the moment. So we haven't really looked back since we started into that breed.
Changing tack for a minute, Emer, are you involved in farm politics a bit?
I suppose you could say that, right? So it was about a year, 2 years ago, cause kind of going for the IFA vice chair position, just to give them a bit of young blood, I suppose. But when I didn't get the position, I went spearheaded, focused really on Mocra, because I've been a Mocra member for years at this stage, I suppose. To be honest, I probably started first when you hear about the discounted car insurance, but stuck with it ever then. The thing was, I was, you know, Galway Mocra, but there was no real club for me. It was kind of no man land between being put in with Headford for a bit, Galway City for a bit, and East Galway, and the farming practices between East and West Galway, there's no comparison. So it was kind of like the COVID project nearly as well as that. When you got home as well, when I suppose 3 years ago now, 2.5 years ago, when I moved back home full time, because I'd been living in the city and I'd be commuting in and out. But when lockdown happened, I just said it was lambing time. The parents were delighted. They were like, look, you can be at home, use the internet, work remotely, and be on hand and desk for the lambing. But it was kind of isolating as well as time. You know, you go from having everyone around to like realizing there's no one really your age living around the place. So we set up Connemara Mocra. So that club, we're going from strength to strength now. Like, we've over, starting off having maybe 5 or 6, we've got over 70 members now. And we're kind of really pushing on like the social side of farming, but also trying to think about how to improve the life of farmers in West of Ireland and hill farmers, that, and try to do like various, you know, I guess we're kind of the stepping stone between IFA and all that sort of thing for young people. And like, you know, you've got Mocra itself to do so much trying to push to improve financing farmers from Europe and everything between the grants and all those policies and schemes. So it is a great kind of how Mocra, it's not, you don't feel like you're involved in farm politics, but indirectly you are, which is, it's a great way to do it. But like, from mentioning Connemara Mocra, we had Club of the Year finals there 2 weeks ago down in Tipperary, and we got to the final 12 out of just well over 150 clubs in Mocra at the moment. So to be in the top 12, we were delighted, because we only set up over a year ago now. So, and one of the members there, Mark, got best new member in the Northwest region. That's my kind of focus at the moment, is while I'm kind of don't have a lot of free time between the farm and PhD at the moment, it means that Mocra is a nice way to do it, because it's very kind of team orientated. Like, we all kind of work together for the common goal of young farmers in the place. And then maybe in the future, when a bit more free time comes along, try and go back towards IFA again.
Okay, very good. Sounds like you might be a name to keep an eye out for in future years, Emer. You mentioned your PhD there a few times and moving to Italy. Tell us a bit all about that. What are you doing that on?
So my PhD focused on, I suppose, the technical title of it really would be advanced therapies in type 1 diabetes, but kind of, you know, layman terms, really, I'm trying to develop, or I'm trying to improve the current treatment of type 1 diabetes, or what people would know as insulin-dependent diabetes. And how I'm trying to do it is just kind of growing blood vessels and implant sites so that when you implant a therapy for diabetes, it will have a better response rate to try and improve, you know, the quality of life for people living with diabetes, because it is a lifelong condition, really. So that was a great opportunity for me. It was a Marie Curie-funded PhD. I kind of always wanted to travel. I still wanted to do a PhD. I wanted to work in industry for a bit, and I was really torn as well. So the timing came right, because I'd taken a year off. After I finished my master's, before starting my PhD, I took a full year out. I moved back home to be farming full time. I feel like I became a forester in that period, actually, at home farming. And when the farming was kind of, you know, all sorted and everything like that, because Dad had been sick and stuff like that. So it was a great time to be at home, get everything right. And my older brother lives at home now, so he'd be taking over the family farm. But it was kind of nice to be there for that transition period, to get everything sorted. So then I could really focus on my PhD. And I did the first year in Ireland, because obviously COVID and everything like that, and I'd be based in the University of Galway in the Duffy Lab there. So it was great to get my basics and have my starting point there of, you know, making the devices I work with. And then for the next 2 years of my PhD, then I moved to Rome in Italy, where I worked in an industry over there. It was actually mostly preclinical facilities. So it was actually an industry that deals with animals a lot, because, you know, a lot of your medical therapies, they all, to be honest, have to be, a lot of them will have to be tested in an animal before they can actually progress to a clinical study where they'd be tested in humans, before actually getting, you know, the seal of approval to be used all the time. So it was kind of, for me, going from one farm to another type of farming, you know, you're dealing with, you know, you might be hands-on with, like, working with pigs, or you might be working with rats or mice. So it was a bit different to, like, you know, in that I'm trying to keep rats alive, whereas when I was at home, you'd be putting out, you know, the cages and the bait box and everything like that. So that was a bit of a difference. But it was a great opportunity, because I got to travel for those 2 years all around mainland Europe, and I joined a GA team over there. So I was able to play in all the European tournaments, going around the place, meeting all the, you know, making so many new friends and everything. So it was a great opportunity to get a break away. And my brother and the parents were at home in the cake, looking after the farm full time. But it was nice there. I moved back just, I suppose, a little over nearly 2 months ago now, I suppose, the end of August, beginning of September, I moved home. So it's nice actually getting back into the farm and kind of swing at things now again. You actually seriously miss it actually after a while. It really keeps you sane. So it does, when you want to stress relief, go out and talk to the animals and they won't listen to you, but at least you can rant away and keep you as calm and as sane as much as possible, really.
Yeah, I think the key thing is they might listen to you, but they don't talk back. So look,
I think that's the key.
Yeah, they won't be giving you right or wrong advice. I suppose, look, you mentioned moving home. Like, what's hill farming like from a young farmer's perspective? Like, where's the future going for it, do you think, Emer?
Yeah, that is kind of a hard one to look at. Like, because more and more I see it around the place is a lot of forestry. Like, a lot of people, you know, that have farms, and they mightn't have the young people to take over, because to get the employment, like hill farming, I just do not see it being your sole income. It's almost like hobby farming in a way. You have to have your own full-time job and have farming as a part-time job nearly. A lot of areas in farming nowadays, you nearly have to move to a city to get your employment or whatever. So that does make a difference. Now, COVID is great. It's, you know, really highlighted how you can work remotely. But there's been so many farms around there that as people get older, they might not be able to keep going with the hill farming, because it is a very, very physical. You know, you've got a lot of hill walking to do and everything like that. It is quite physically demanding. People kind of go for the easier route, I suppose, is plant it for forestry and make good money on it. But which is a pity, because you're, you know, biodiversity be a big thing. And like, we'd be involved with Joseph Thayer Mannion with the North Connemara locally led agri environmental scheme. It's a bit of a mouthful, but that one's a great one. It's about all about biodiversity in rural West Ireland and Connemara in particular, and sustainability. So with that scheme, it's all about thinking about the land itself. Like, I know the government will go on about emissions, this, that and the other, but and overgrazing and that. But with this scheme, it's brilliant because, you know, you have the education there of like what species of grassland should be on your hills, like what wild animals should be there, everything like that. And it's all about how as a farmer you can improve nature and how can nature can help you. So I think with schemes like that, it's positive for being a hill farmer because you're getting, you know, you're getting the most out of your land. But as well as that, then you're having various safety courses, upskilling and everything like that. So I think more funding towards those kind of schemes and just, you know, national, like rural broadband, everything like that will really help keep the idea of keeping young people in rural Ireland to try and keep the hill farming going, because it is vital really that we keep the hill farming going. I suppose one of the big things is, like, you know, I could go into a massive list of like how we need, why we need to keep going and you know, propose ways to do it. But it is kind of a worry at this transition now with all this global warming talk and everything. It's like, will you be told to cut down the number of sheep next, and will that really be the first way to go is hill farming? But it is kind of more a very organic, so hopefully in the future it keeps going, but we'll see maybe in another few years how it's looking.
Yeah, and I suppose before we get to a quick fire question round, just like, is there enough being done, I suppose, to attract young people into the sector in general? And that's either from a lowland point of view or a hill farmer point of view. Like, there's obviously more of a focus, I'd say, on dairy and, you know, more profitable enterprises, shall we say. Like, is there enough being done in general to attract young farmers into the sector, do you think, Eimear?
Personally speaking, I don't think so. Like, you know, if you look every week there where you see the front page of the Farmers Journal and it's like, you know, culling your suckler cows, having a max number because of all this methane thing. I think, you know, to step back, the government, I know you've great intentions and everything like that, so they do, but just to step back and think of simple things like sustainability, like give farmers grants so that they can set up, you know, improve the grants there so that farmers can have, whatchamacallit, wind turbines or solar panels, things like that in their farms. So at least with the young people, we can have this kind of sustainable farming so that, you know, we're not using, say, you know, electricity that's from a non-renewable source. We have a renewable source of electricity, we have our renewable source of water. Things like making those little changes can go a long way, rather than like going straight away hitting people with being like, okay, you can only farm where it's really profitable, a fast turnover, like how, you know, if you keep the animals for longer, that's more methane, so we should slaughter them at an earlier age. Like, I think there's just so much things about methane and hitting the suckler farmers and like that. And I suppose from a sheep farmer, I should be concerned, but we do have the sucklers, and, you know, I suppose being a hobby farm, they're almost like your pets and everything like that. You take great pride. It's a family farm. It's been there for years and you want to make sure it's there for the next couple of generations and everything. Like, every generation works there on farm to try and improve it. So I think really what the government need to do is just focus on little things bit by bit, like the sustainability, having all the energy you use on a farm, renewable sources. Like when you're washing down the milk and parlors, many farmers already have it, but they're, you know, using wastewater from, say, just gathering it off the rainwater from roots and that, and using that to wash down milk and powder. It's like just having all those first and then, you know, hit them hard. But with the other side of things, and just, you know, making things like broadband widely available, like in our area now, like we're one of the last houses back our road that have got what's called fiber broadband, just because we're really close to the head of the road where the Garda barracks and things like that. But anyone back further past our house, they don't really have internet. And in this day and age, when you're trying to remote work, it's impossible. Whereas I'm fortunate, I can do a lot of my remote work and be at home. And the days I need to be in the lab, I can be in Galway. So it allows me to kind of have that work on the farm, work and things. So just those little bits, if the government would try and help young farmers making those kind of changes, it would go a long way.
Okay, I think that's a very fair point, Eimear. We're going to run into a quick fire round now. So quick fire, and if you don't answer the question, I'll be after you. So if you're out for dinner, do you prefer a starter or dessert?
Dessert.
If you're going into the deli, chicken fillet roll or breakfast roll?
Chicken fillet roll.
Would you call it a trough or a trock?
Gosh, trough, I guess. Yeah, trough.
We know you're not milking, but if you were to go milking, would you prefer a herringbone or rotary parlour?
I'm going to go for a rotary.
Okay.
I'm probably going to get shot for that answer, but you're lucky.
We'll find out. A fork, sprung, or a grape, which do you call it?
Fork.
Thank God. I thought I was the only one that called it a fork.
It's a Galway thing, so.
It is a Galway thing. The grapes are something you put in wine. Peter Bale silage.
Oh, I have to pick between them. Oh, God. We don't have any of the above. I'd have to go for Bale then. I'll pretend it's a bale of hay.
Okay. And final questions. Would you rather pick stones or foot turf?
Oh, God. The midges and foot and turf. They're great for the hamstrings, as I say, are picking stones. I'll have to go with foot and turf.
Oh, God. Okay. Controversial. Eimear Wallace, thanks a million for joining us on the Young Stock Podcast.
Thank you so much, Amy, for having me on.
Thanks to Eimear for joining us for that great chat. Okay, next up, our own Martin Merrick has the latest prices as of Monday morning, 14th of November 2022. That's over to you, Martin.
7,856,
Hi folks, and welcome again to Martin's Markets. Now, all our prices are correct as of the 14th of November 2022. Kicking off, prices are holding firm for cattle in factories with an expected rise for the Christmas trade in the next few weeks. The rapid flush of cattle with the deteriorating ground conditions seems to have passed, and agents are now filling quotas and seeking to secure numbers. Base price for steers is running at 450 to 455 a kg, with heifers 10 cent a kilo above this. Donegal based foil meats are the leaders in price, with a base of 465 for steers and 470 for heifers. All grading cows are trading at 430 to 440, with all graders at 4 euro to 420 a kilo. P grading cows are trading at 380 to 390 for the most part. Young bulls are being secured at 450 to 460 a kg. In Northern Ireland, cattle are running at nearly 50 cent a kg ahead of Republic of Ireland prices. U3 grading animals are selling for 428 sterling a kg, equivalent of 5 euro 19 a kg, while deals are being secured for heifers as high as £4.46 a kg, equivalent of 5 euro and 40 cent a kilo. Now, in a similar way to beef, lamb prices appear to have bottomed out and are now rising. Deals of 6 euro 30 a kg are being achieved by small producers this week, with larger producers and groups likely to secure 10 to 15 cent a kilo above this. Store lambs are still expected to be a stickier trade than last year due to input prices. Butcher lambs are trading at 230 to 288 kg or 132 to 149 euro a head, while store lambs are selling for 270 to 286 kg or 80 to 113 euro per head.
5800 now, 5800, Thanks, Martin, and you can read the latest prices on farmersjournal.ie. Well, that's all we have time for this week on the Young Stock Podcast. We'll be back next Monday. Thanks, as always, for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.